Methodology Minutes is brought to you by the Methodology Center at Penn State, your source for cutting-edge research methodology in the social, behavioral, and health sciences.
I'm here today to talk with Linda Collins and Stephanie Lanza about their new book called Latent Class and Latent Transition Analysis with Applications in the Social, Behavioral, and Health Sciences. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Linda Collins and Stephanie Lanza.
Thank you, Michael.
First, I'll just give a little bit of background about the two of you, reading from the back of the book. Linda Collins is Director of the Methodology Center and Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the Pennsylvania State University. Stephanie Lanza is Scientific Director and Senior Research Associate at the Methodology Center at Penn State. The book is part of the Wiley series in Probability and Statistics and was published by Wiley in December of 2009, but has a copyright date of 2010. I want to start by just reading a little bit from the back of the book to give the listeners a sense of what the book is about, and then we can kind of go from there. So the back of the book states, on a daily basis, researchers in the social, behavioral, and health sciences collect information and fit statistical models to the gathered empirical data with the goal of making significant advances in these fields. In many cases, it can be useful to identify latent or unobserved subgroups in a population. This book, Latent Class and Latent Transition Analysis, provides a comprehensive and unified introduction for this topic. Can we start by just talking about latent class analysis in general? Can you perhaps use one of the examples in the book to help those listeners who are a little bit unfamiliar with LCA?
Well, maybe we can start by drawing a parallel with an approach that some of our listeners may already be familiar with, factor analysis. Mm-hmm. So factor analysis is a latent variable model where there are observed variables that are intended to measure an unseen, sometimes called unmeasured, latent variable. And in factor analysis, the latent variable has a continuous distribution, typically a normal distribution. In latent class analysis, that latent variable is categorical.
It might help if we draw our attention to an empirical example that is presented in the book in Chapter 5. We downloaded data from the Monitoring the Future study from the year 2004, which is a data set about the health and behavior in high school adolescents. We looked at the sample of high school seniors and wanted to identify groups of individuals based on a whole range of health behaviors. We looked at whether or not they reported eating breakfast regularly, eating green vegetables or some fruit, whether they exercised vigorously, and whether they reported getting at least 7 hours of sleep each night. And based on their responses to these five different health behaviors, we were able to identify five underlying types of high school seniors in the United States. One group was labeled the unhealthy adolescents, who were unlikely to report any of these five behaviors. The second latent class we labeled sleep-deprived. This group was characterized by pretty typical behaviors of adolescents, but were unlikely to report getting enough sleep. This class was quite a bit more prevalent among females. A typical latent class emerged, which was a large portion of the male population and a smaller portion of the female population. And the fourth group was a healthy eaters latent class. And finally, we had a healthy latent class, which, of course, we were happy to find in this sample, which is more likely among males. So in addition to having the healthy eating behaviors, they also were likely to report eating breakfast every day and exercising vigorously and getting at least 7 hours of sleep.
Can you just maybe give us a more general kind of sense of what LCA is doing to get those groups?
Well, it's based on the likelihood of a particular group member responding in a particular way to one of the questions. So, for example, the healthy eaters group were people who were very likely to say that they ate breakfast nearly every day or every day, and were pretty unlikely to say that they never ate breakfast.
Okay. So
you can look at that pattern of the likelihood of responses across the various questionnaire items. And that's what distinguishes one group from another.
Okay. A follow-up question to this example here. Are there any other interesting analyses that you did with this particular example that the listeners might want to be aware of that you could do with a typical LCA approach?
One interesting result that we found was that maternal education was highly related to membership in these different health behavior groups. However, that association varied across gender. What we found was among female seniors, a higher maternal education corresponded to an increased odds of membership in both the healthy eaters and the overall healthy latent classes. But that relationship didn't really exist for males.
Mm-hmm.
The association we expected, we only found among females.
To go back to my original question, which was to use an example to introduce the listener to LCA, I noticed when thumbing through the book that there are quite a few other empirical examples used, and I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about those examples and wanted to know, first of all, how did you come up with so many examples, and you know, what were you looking for when you were looking for examples to use in this book?
Well, one thing we wanted was examples that came from publicly available data sets. So mm-hmm. we didn't use any examples from, for example, work with collaborators where the data belong to a project and aren't on a website that can be downloaded. So that was one criterion. And we were interested in examples that told a story that where something interesting emerged from the data.
Mm-hmm. I also noticed that a lot of the examples are what could be termed, let's say, messy a little bit.
A lot of them are messy. We wanted to use examples that are like the kinds of messy examples that we come across in normal data analysis, because we mm-hmm. figure that that's the kinds of analyses that our readers will be doing. And so we didn't want to convey a false sense of what it's like mm-hmm. to be doing latent class and latent transition analyses on empirical data.
We are hoping that many of the readers of our book are actually social, behavioral, and health scientists and actively conducting research in their areas. Their data is messy, I guarantee you. And we wanted to provide a treatment of latent class and latent transition analysis that was accessible to these scientists so mm-hmm. that they can see how we would work through issues that might arise in their research. In the Methodology Center, we develop software for conducting latent class and latent transition analysis.
Sure.
The main reason we develop software and distribute it on the internet is that we want to make user-friendly software that can handle estimation issues that can arise in real, messy analyses.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. So once again, the idea that this is a realistic portrayal of what a listener who potentially might be using LCA is going to encounter.
That's right.
Okay. Very good. Can I ask why now? Why did you write this book, and what made you decide to write the book now?
Well, probably like most people, we talked about it for a while before we finally decided to write it. We both felt that there was a need for, first of all, a book that was comprehensive, that kind of went from very simple and standard latent class models all the way through to much more complex latent class models. We also felt that there was a need for a book that was technical in the sense that it didn't back away from some of the difficult technical aspects of latent class analysis, but also explain things in a conceptual way.
Now, what audience is this book aimed? I know you mentioned comprehensive book that covers both the technical and the conceptual details of LCA and LTA. Is this book appropriate for users listeners who have never used LCA? Is it appropriate for people who've been using LCA or LTA for several years?
We really tried to cover the range in this book. If you were to sit down and read chapter one, the general introduction, that chapter would be accessible to someone who has absolutely no familiarity with LCA or related statistical methods.
Mm-hmm.
We think this book would be ideal for graduate students, for postdoctoral researchers, mm-hmm. for scientists out there, professors who are conducting research on messy data who believe that there may be some underlying subgroups in their data.
And even someone who's pretty familiar with latent class analysis may not be familiar with latent transition analysis, so that would potentially be another reason for taking a look at the book.
Very good, very good. Speaking along those lines of different types of users and different levels of experience, how technical is the book?
In writing the book, we tried not to back off from technical details. They're in there. But we also tried to use the examples to explain things conceptually as well.
I would actually recommend to readers to read at the level that they're comfortable with. And if you come from an applied background, mm-hmm. read the general introduction and read the empirical examples throughout, and you will get a very good understanding of what these methods are, what the parameters are, and how they can use this in their research.
Mm-hmm.
That said, if you come from a more statistical background and can understand the formulas, for many readers, that would be the place to start and mm-hmm. go from there.
Mm-hmm. I want to spend the next few minutes talking about the actual content of the book and get into the details of each chapter, or at least maybe some of the major points in each chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You've divided the book into three major sections, and the first part is titled Fundamentals. It includes the first four chapters. Begins with a general introduction to latent class analysis that we've already covered a little bit, but I'd like to go into a little bit more of the details in these first few chapters. Can you kind of walk us through some of the highlights of this first section?
So chapter one provides a very basic, general, and very conceptual introduction to both latent class analysis, which is for cross-sectional data, and latent transition analysis, which is for longitudinal data. In that first chapter, we don't really get into anything technical at all. We're just trying to get things across in a very conceptual way as kind of a foundation for the rest of the book. In chapter two, we get into the mathematical model, notation and assumptions, and we present some additional empirical analyses. In chapter three, we talk about the relation between the latent variable and the observed variables. There's some material in chapter three that I've never seen anywhere else. We talk in very conceptual terms about how to interpret the overall pattern of results in a latent class analysis.
In chapter four, we go into the more technical details of latent class analysis. And here I'm talking about the mathematical model that's underlying a latent class model and what those parameters are. But
okay.
we also got into those fun and messy issues of model selection, model fit, and model identification. So if anyone has attempted a latent class model in the past, they're familiar with these issues.
It's the messiest part.
Once again, that idea of the realistic portrayal of data.
Absolutely. For example, in our five-class model of positive health behaviors in among the high school seniors,
mm-hmm.
we started with a data set of only five variables, but each one had three response categories. Whether the adolescents never or seldom engaged in that particular behavior, or sometimes they did it, or they did it basically every day. In this relatively simple example, with only five variables, we had a contingency table of 243 cells.
Hmm.
So you can imagine that that not all of those cells were well represented in our data set.
Right.
Section two is about advanced features of LCA. We cover in chapter five, incorporating a grouping variable into latent class models. And in chapter six, we go into incorporating covariates into the model so that you can predict who may be likely to belong in the different latent classes. This is where I think a lot of the scientific questions really get addressed.
Before we get to the final part three, I wanted to back up a little bit and talk about part one. You didn't say much about model selection, but I know that's a big topic for a lot of listeners, I'm sure, out there that have ran these models and estimated LCA before. What can you say about model selection?
What's the bottom line?
What's the bottom line? Is there a bottom line?
One point that I hope we made in the book is there's not one true model.
Hmm.
There's no one latent class model that represents the underlying groups that actually exist in your population.
I think it was G.E.P. Box, famous statistician, who said, all models are wrong, some models are useful.
Yes.
I think that's kind of our perspective on this.
Good.
We
mm-hmm.
we believe that models are not so much an expression of the truth in some absolute sense as they are a lens by which you can look at your data mm-hmm. to reveal interesting things.
That's a very nice quote.
I like that too.
I hope it was Box who said it. I'm gonna go look it up, but I think it was.
That's right. So we would never claim that there are five types of adolescents in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Two,
only five.
And they are either unhealthy, yes, or they're sleep deprived, or right, typical, or a healthy eater, or a healthy adolescent. Mm-hmm. That's not at all the case. Mm-hmm. However, LCA was a great tool for us to take a lens to these data and say, together, these five subgroups can really characterize the multifaceted health behaviors in high school seniors today.
Mm-hmm. So it's very useful to start at least with this.
Well, yes, these five latent classes distill the essence of 243 cells in a contingency table.
Good point.
So it's much more meaningful to think of mm-hmm. these five latent classes and then try to use covariates and grouping variables to explain the five latent classes mm-hmm. than to stay with the 243 cells and try to make sense
right.
out of
no
them.
One could do that. That's
no.
an impossible
no.
task.
Mm-hmm.
But Michael, getting back to your question about model selection.
Yes.
We didn't mean to dodge it.
Thorny issue.
Yes, but I guess the point I wanted to make is there's not one right answer and every other answer is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bit of an art, and I think it's important to keep that in mind so that the different fit indicators that you can get in LCA and mm-hmm. LTA will help you in guide your choice, but that at the end of the day, it has to be an interpretable solution.
Just to remind our listeners, LCA stands for latent class analysis. LTA is latent transition analysis, which is covered in part 3 of the book, mm-hmm. Latent class models for longitudinal data. And can you just give us a few ideas of what's covered in those last three chapters of the book?
Right. So latent transition analysis is kind of a unique feature of this book. Latent transition analysis, as we mentioned before, is an extension of latent class analysis to longitudinal panel data. So with LTA, you can model movement between latent classes. So there's an array of latent classes at each time, but people may not be in the same latent class. In fact, probably won't be in the same latent class across the various times.
Mm-hmm.
And so you estimate what's called a transition probability matrix that expresses the probability of changing into a latent class at time 2, say, conditional on latent class membership at time 1.
Stephanie, can you maybe give an example of an application of LTA?
Sure. In Chapter 7, Linda and I present an example of sexual risk behavior among late adolescents and early adults in the United States. In this model, we were considering different aspects of sexual behavior, including the number of dating partners and whether or not the individual reported having sex, the number of sexual partners that they had, and also a measure of possible exposure to STIs. And so we felt that this would encompass sort of a broad range of sexual risk behaviors, going from the very early dating behaviors mm-hmm. to more high risk, multi-partner, unsafe sex.
Mm-hmm.
In this example, we found five latent classes of individuals. We labeled them non-daters. As you can imagine, they were not even dating yet and were not having sex. A latent class of daters,
mm-hmm.
a monogamous latent class that was likely to be having intercourse with just one partner. And then we had two multi-partner latent classes, one that was engaging in safe sex every time, mm-hmm. and the other that wasn't. And so we labeled them the multi-partner exposed latent class.
Mm-hmm.
And the most interesting part of the study was that we looked at this behavior longitudinally. So over the course of 3 years, we found that one group of these adolescents was at high risk for transitioning into the multi-partner exposed latent class, and that was the mm-hmm. monogamous class.
Well, I think it's interesting that people didn't transition so much from multi-partner safe to multi-partner exposed.
That's right, not at all. Part of what's going on there is that these individuals in the monogamous latent class, they were quite likely to not be using condoms regularly. Again, they were with just one partner.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't seem to be as much of a concern. But then when they transition into having multiple sexual partners, mm-hmm. in that setting, they're also not using condoms.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So continuing with this example, going back to maybe some of the other chapters in part three, can you also do some of the more advanced techniques that you described with latent class analysis, adding multi-group analysis or covariates to the LTA model?
Yes, you can use both a multiple groups approach, and you can introduce covariates with LTA. Both of those approaches are explained in Chapter 8.
We demonstrate both of those approaches using the sexual risk behavior example. We found that the prevalence of three of the latent classes was equal across genders. That's the non-daters, the daters, and the high-risk class, the multi-partner exposed.
That's interesting.
It is. It gets even more interesting when you look at the monogamous and the multi-partner safe class. The females are more than twice as likely to report being in the monogamous latent class, whereas the males are twice as likely to report being in the multi-partner safe latent class. Now, when I present this to groups, they often ask, do the females think they're in monogamous relationships and the males think not and report truthfully? We also took a look at how substance use behaviors are associated with high-risk sexual behavior, and we found that while cigarette use was mildly related, it was drunkenness and marijuana use that were both really strongly associated with high-risk behavior.
Right. Well, Stephanie, at the very beginning of the podcast, you mentioned a little bit about ProcLCA and the software that's distributed through the Methodology Center website. Did you use ProcLCA to run all of these analyses, estimate these models in the book?
We did. So in the Methodology Center, about 2.5 years ago, we began releasing software for latent class and latent transition analysis as SAS procedures.
And of course, they can fit these models using other methods and other software as well?
Yes, available software includes Latent Gold and M+, and there are a few others out there as well.
Okay. So for the readers who want to try to replicate these examples, and whether they're using ProcLCA or M+, Latent Gold, whatever, how can they go about going through the book and trying to replicate example by example the results that you found?
Well, we set up a website with some supplemental material on it. On that website is information about how to obtain the data that we used from the publicly available data sets on the web. Most of the examples are based on subsets of data, so we explain how to get the subsets you would need.
Sure.
And then we also include the ProcLCA or ProcLTA code, so it would be possible for readers to try to replicate the examples in the book.
Great. The website that we've been referring to is methodology.psu.edu/latentclassbook, and latent class book is all together there with no spaces. How do listeners actually order a copy of the book?
Listeners can order a copy of the book from the Wiley website or from Amazon.com or other online book vendors.
Well, Linda and Stephanie, it's been very fascinating talking about the book today with you and getting into the details of LCA and LTA. And I'd like to kind of end this with just a little bit of maybe a more personal question or two. What was it like to write this book? What was the writing process like and your collaboration together?
Well, fortunately, Stephanie and I have been collaborating for a long time, so there weren't a lot of surprises. The way we divided up the work was Stephanie amazingly found all the great examples in the book and did the model fitting for those. It was usually my job to write a first draft of every chapter, with a couple of exceptions. And then Stephanie's job was to give me comments that were about as long as the first draft of the chapter in most cases.
And then we followed that up by intensive writing retreat meetings where we would come together and sort of hash it out.
How long did the process take from beginning to end?
About a year and a half.
There was a maternity leave delay.
That's right. There was that, yes.
About a year and a half.
Yeah, roughly. And we also wrote the book in LaTeX. I don't know how many of our listeners know what LaTeX is. It's it's a freeware word processing software program that is simultaneously extremely versatile and extremely maddening. So it was kind of an immersion program for me in, mm-hmm. in LaTeX. But mm-hmm. The nice thing about writing a book in LaTeX is that you typeset it as you go. But no, we never slugged each other.
You're still here together talking.
That's right. So. Yeah.
We still work together.
We still work together. No, it was really a great experience writing the book. I've worked in the area of latent class and latent transition analysis for a long time, and I feel like I learned a lot by working mm-hmm. on the book. When you're writing a book, you find yourself questioning things. Like you write something and you say, "Do I really mean that?" And then you end up going off and learning a lot about it. So it was a really good experience in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. It really was. When you have to put something down on paper that mm-hmm. you think you know, it's amazing how much you realize you don't know. And mm-hmm. we had to learn. But so many times, I can't count how many times both Linda and I said, I could never have written this book alone.
Absolutely. No,
I don't believe it.
Yeah, I don't think either one of us could have written it alone. It was a real team effort.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you both for being with me today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us, Michael.
You have been listening to Methodology Minutes, brought to you by the Methodology Center at Penn State, your source for cutting-edge research methodology in the social, behavioral, and health sciences. This podcast is available on iTunes and at methodology.psu.edu.